This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today we'll be taking a look at, what is the never-ending theme song, is it? WWF Superstars from November 16th, 1991. Everything was running hot in the WWF at that time, in what I have called on many occasions now on this show, the mini-attitude era. There was a lot going on this taping from Fort Wayne, Indiana, which I will get into in a moment. And by a lot, I mean a lot. I can't imagine what it was like to sit through this taping. But at the very least, there was a lot of stuff going on in the show. Before I get into all that, some plugs quickly. On Facebook, you can find me at, and it took me a long time to figure this out. For a long time, I've just been saying, just search me out at GF Allentown, as if that was my name, Jeff Allentown, or something like that, because they made me, I didn't really want to use my real name, because I've always vowed to never have a Facebook account, so this is purely a show account. So, you know, don't rat me out to Facebook or anything like that, but you can find me there at facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown, or at least I think you can. In any event, it'll lead to me. The internet is a fun place where you can, it'll track you back, you know, all that. Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod, and on SoundCloud at two places on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I'm proud to be a member of that extended family. And then, of course, I have my own feed, which I paid for the whole year. So it'll go all the way through to next February, I think was the first episode I did of this wonderful little program that I've been doing. So back to this taping in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that had a lot going on. And Vince at the top of the show screws something up. This was the period of time where Vince McMahon would like to give the local fact. Sometimes it would be inane stuff like, we're here at the Providence Civic Center and Tiffany will be appearing live here in 1 week. As if the Tiffany audience and the WWF audience, like there's a lot of crossover there. He tells us that Fort Wayne, Indiana is the home of Dr. Scholl, which now, of course, we can look that sort of stuff up very, very easily. And we find out that it is not true. Maybe he lived in Fort Wayne for a period of time, but Dr. Scholl himself, Dr. William Scholl, is from LaPorte, Indiana, which is much closer to Chicago or South Bend, Indiana, home of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. So before I get into what exactly was on this television taping, taped on October 21st, 1991, I need to talk about a few items that were going on in the WWF behind the scenes at the time of this taping. Number one, you had Sid Vicious, or Sid Justice, as he was known during this very all-too-brief Sid as a super babyface period of time. He had a torn bicep, and he had torn his bicep in early October, but they never announced it on television until November 9th episode, so the week before this. So Sid is now out of the Survivor Series, and it's a question of who's going to take his place. And of course, everybody wanted the Macho Man Randy Savage to be reinstated, and you have a reinstate chant at the top of the show. Not exactly the easiest word and the best one for a chant, and it did sound a little too clean, a little too piped in. So you have Sid out, and you wouldn't see him again until January. He would be, of course, back for the Royal Rumble, and he would do matches with The Undertaker around that period of time. A second person who would be out, and this one for good, was The Dragon, Ricky Steamboat. Of course, he was only being called The Dragon during 1991, which kind of annoyed me because even though I was a 12-year-old, I guess I fashioned myself as an old soul. I knew exactly who he was. I knew he was the NWA champion for a spell in 1989, and I wondered why you couldn't just call him Ricky Steamboat. Well, they had put a little bit into the push of the Dragon. It's not like he was losing on TV or anything like that. His pay might not have been what Steamboat had wanted, but they were setting him up for a feud with the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, with the idea being that Steamboat, who was doing the fire-breathing trick before his matches, where he would blow this big flame off the corner turnbuckle into the air, that he would blow it at DiBiase and would burn up his money somehow. I'm kind of scratching my head. This is all kind of newsletter speculation behind that. And, of course, that wouldn't happen, as Steamboat refused to do a couple of jobs on this taping, per the history of WWE.com, Graham Cawthon's great resource of a website there. He refused to do jobs for The Undertaker and IRS, so death in taxes. Steamboat refused to do that, and he was fired. And there was a lot of animosity there because Vince had felt that he had put something into the push of the Dragon, and he just kind of took off. And he was signed for a period of time after that, but somehow was able to show up in WCW a mere month later at the Clash of the Champions, which, truth be told, actually did not air too long after this would have aired on Superstars November 16th. That Clash, if I remember, was November 19th. And Steamboat turned out to be the mystery partner of Dustin Rhodes in the tag team title match against Arn Anderson and Larry Zbyszko, the Enforcers, which only turned out to be one of the best WCW tag matches of all time, one of the best tag matches of 1991. It's a classic Southern tag match, and it's probably something that, now that I mention it, I'm probably going to need to go back and not only watch that match itself, but probably all of Clash 17. But got to keep my mind focused for now on the WWF. But still an issue between the two promotions, very public, with regards to the NWA / WCW world title belt. It's kind of a weird gray area there. Of course, this is in reference to the big gold belt, which was being carried on WWF television by Ric Flair, and we do see it on this show. And there was negotiations ongoing. A lawsuit had been filed by WCW, and it was around this time period, but after this week, but before the 23rd, next week's show, where the NWA title would get pixelated, they would come to a settlement, they would return the title belt to WCW, and of course they would start the blur out gimmick, where Jack Tunney ordered Ric Flair's belt to be blurred out on the broadcast. Now, of course, they weren't going to just stop having Ric Flair carrying around a belt. Instead, they gave him all manner of phony belts, including something that looked like a WWF tag team belt. There was another one where they made it look exactly like the big gold belt, and it was so close that the court stepped in and said, "Nah, we don't think you could do that." But the important thing about that case, which, according to reports, was settled around $50,000 or something like that to return the belt and this and that kind of stuff. The important thing that that case settled was that championship belts are the intellectual property of the promotion. So if somebody were to take the then WWF Winged Eagle belt onto WCW television, the principle was now established that that would be against the law because it would be using the intellectual property of another promotion and, you know, and all that. Now, of course, that would come back to burn WCW because, of course, it would. Of course, they would be stupid enough to not realize something like this had happened. Although, to be fair, Eric Bischoff's idea to have Medusa drop the WWF women's title in the trash, Bischoff really wasn't much of a player in 91, But you would think that somebody in the WCW legal department, if that was actually a thing, I mean, can you imagine what that work, the person at Turner who was in charge of the wrestling legal, I'm sure that they were really hard at work at all times. So, of course, they end up violating that, and then they got into a lot of trouble there. So there was a lot going on during this time period, and a lot going on at this taping. And the WWF was famous for having these long television tapings that would go on and on and on and last upwards of 5 hours. And this is a case where the website wrestlingdata.com is kind of fun to look at because it gives the complete results of the entire taping from the first match all the way to the last match. It would include dark matches that, of course, would not air on television, which included stuff like Chris Chavis defeated Skinner. Now, of course, Chris Chavis would eventually debut as Tatanka in early 1992. There are 30 matches on this card, from the first match to the last match. This covers three superstars, and maybe they threw something in on primetime wrestling. Of course, you also have three funeral parlors as well, which, granted, are all about probably maybe 5 minutes or so. But so here are some odds and ends about these 30 matches we have here. Virgil wrestled 4 times on this night. What a treat for the fans in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Virgil defeated the Brooklyn Brawler. He defeated Hercules. He defeated Ted DiBiase, which obviously was a dark match. And he also defeated Steve Dupree in 55 seconds. So, big night for Virgil there. We had a couple of Road Warriors matches. We had Ric Flair defeating Jim Neidhart, which was an injury angle that'll be covered in the update segment we get to later. Ric Flair also defeated Roddy Piper, which was very common during his early WWF run. Piper was putting over Ric Flair left and right, including a dark match on the This Tuesday in Texas show, which, of course, did not air and wasn't taped because, of course, Piper, not exactly a guy who was willing to lose too often on television. You have Big Bully Busick matches, and he would be gone shortly after this. In fact, his match on the 23rd of November against Bret Hart for the Intercontinental title would prove to be his last match on television. We're not talking about 23rd, we're talking about November 16th, 1991, and there was a lot of famous stuff that happened on this show. Well, you know, some of it is more famous than others. I mean, the funeral parlor with Hulk Hogan is the greatest funeral parlor of all time, and even ranks above, in my mind, the Ultimate Warrior being locked in a casket for 3 minutes and 46 seconds, which, by the way, if you go to my archives, I covered that in insane detail. That would be episode number 12. On this show, you have not only that, you have the debut of Repo Man, whose vignettes were still kind of running at this point, and he debuts in a match against Reno Riggins, who I'll have a lot to say about. You have the Rockers in action in the opening bout, and this is where you start to see some of the tension between them. Of course, I covered their famous barbershop breakup in episode 5 and covered some of the key points that led up to their breakup. I did not cover this episode of Superstars because it was very kind of minute, but it was also very weird looking the way it went down. And I don't know if I would call this the feature match, but it is a match between two named guys. Irwin R. Scheister taking on Greg the Hammer Valentine in a rematch, or what was effectively a rematch from SummerSlam 1991. And also in action, we have the Natural Disasters and the British Bulldog. So let's just jump right in. OPP, how can I explain it? I'll take it frame by frame it. To have y'all all jump and shout and say it. Show kicks off with the Rockers taking on Barry Horowitz and Mark Buenavera. Not really much on him. Of course, Horowitz was one of the starring figures in the WCW Worldwide episode a few weeks ago, taking on Chris Benoit. And the Rockers here, they're wearing those green hats that I wouldn't remember except for one thing. During the Jake the Snake Cobra bite angle, and they were showing the crowd reactions to it, like the horrified children crying, I always remember the heavyset woman who it looks like she's kind of laughing at it, who's wearing one of the green Rockers hats. I'll have to find a screenshot of that and post it on either Facebook or Twitter just as a reference. It's literally the only way I would remember that those hats actually exist. And Piper and Savage refer to the Rockers as the tag team of the 90s, which is something they were very much pushing at this time, even as the angle was beginning to break the two up. I should also mention that Howard Finkel is not the ring announcer for this show. Instead, we're stuck with Mel Phillips, so good thing all the boys are wearing their wrestling boots here today. So we start out with Marty and Barry in the ring, and they have a nice little exchange, and Marty looks like he's going for a crucifix or something at one point and just kind of gives up on it halfway and works it into a gut wrench suplex, which actually, you know, not so bad. I'm kind of pointing it out just for the sake of pointing it out. So he recovered pretty nicely there. Then Barry does a bump for Sean. Sean gets tagged in by Marty and just kind of gets like a back elbow or just like one move. And then Sean immediately tags back out. And you wonder, that's a little weird. What's going on there? And meanwhile on commentary, there's some stuff going on. I have no idea what the hell Piper is talking about. And this is, you know, pretty common for some of the Piper of this period. He'd be off commentary not long after this. You would get the McMahon and Mr. Perfect duo on Superstars after around this Tuesday in Texas when Macho Man started wrestling again, and Piper took a much more active wrestling role around this time. He was, you know, as I mentioned, working house shows with Ric Flair and whatnot. Anyway, Piper starts talking about this Granny Anderson, and I'm left scratching my head here.
And it's also on pay-per-view, right?
Hey, that's so Granny Anderson way up there in the lumber camps. Old Granny Anderson, I love her. I ain't seen her in 30 years, but she ain't never missed a pay-per-view.
You haven't seen your grandmother in 30 years?
Well, it's been a while, man. Yeah.
I'm real nice family man.
Okay, his references to Granny Anderson really struck me as bizarre. And if you do a search for Granny Anderson, Roddy Piper, you don't really get anywhere. But Anderson is actually the maiden name of Roddy Piper's mother, Eileen Toombs. Her maiden name was Anderson. And the fact that he's referring to up in, like, the wood country or whatever it was that he said is, I guess, a reference to the fact that he grew up in the Great Plains of Canada, which, I don't know, that it's a really oblique, odd reference to the fact that Piper is not actually from Scotland, which I don't know what he was getting at. Piper just does a lot of weird stuff on promos that I never quite understand, like, you know, the SummerSlam 89 promo where he says that he's going to go eat a garage, which find out years later that eat a garage may have certain connotations to do a bunch of a white powder, shall we say. In any event, this match is not very long at all. As I said, Sean tags out and he's just kind of walking down the apron, apparently flirting with a girl in the crowd, it is said, but they don't show anybody in the crowd that he would be talking to. And as I said, this is kind of the start of the dissension, because Marty goes to tag out, and Sean's not there. So here, Sean is clearly established as being at fault for, you know, turning his back and, you know, not having his eyes on the prize. And he gets rolled up in a victory roll by Barry Horowitz, and Jannetty manages to reverse it. Now, even though Horowitz is literally like in the ropes, his arm is underneath the bottom rope, they still count three, which, I don't know, it's a TV squash match, but just a really weird ending and just kind of screwed up. And the announcers aren't even really talking about it too much. They're like, well, they're going to be ready for the Survivor Series anyway. They're teaming up with the Bushwhackers. And it's like, okay, well, that's fine. So, I mean, you could take like a scorecard of who's at fault, You know, who would be the heel? In my memory, yes, there were a few, maybe one or two occasions where you could say, all right, Marty is kind of at fault there. I point to the Shawn Michaels match with Ric Flair where he just kind of threw him back into the ring when he could have just been counted out, but instead threw him back into the ring so he would be pinned. Of course, you would rank a count-out loss something above a pinfall loss, and Marty caused him to do that. Of course, Gorilla Monsoon screwed up at the Survivor Series with the Shawn and Marty bit, where he was saying that Marty Jannetty didn't want to tag into the match when the idea was that Shawn was hot dogging it and wouldn't tag out of the match. So we get the Rockers here, and they're just kind of starting their. It's funny that they're starting their breakup here as the commentators are declaring them the team for the next 8 years, and they wouldn't even be a team on television 8 weeks from that very point. We have Gene Okerlund with the update here, and it is sponsored by Coliseum Home Video, the exclusive distributors of the WBF Championship on VHS, which I know you must be clamoring for. I should see if that's on eBay for about 3 cents, because I'm not even sure it would even be worth that much. And the update is about Jim the Anvil Neidhart and how he's going to be out of the Survivor Series, which I'm sure really affected the buy rate quite a bit, that Jim Neidhart as a singles wrestler was not going to be at the Survivor Series. He had been injured the week before, as I alluded to, by Ric Flair, who put him in the figure four leg lock and had done a lot of working on the leg prior to that. But wait, that's not all. Ric Flair, of course, claimed to have never beaten anybody with the figure four leg lock, obviously in jest. He picked up the win there, and Neidhart had to be helped from the ring. And yet another one of those scenarios that I always love, where the guy is coming down for the next match as the injured guy is being carried out. So what we had was the new-to-the-scene Beverly Brothers, also known as the Minnesota Wrecking Crew No. 2 under masks in the NWA, but also the Destruction Crew in the AWA, and probably the last AWA team that was worth a damn, in my opinion. They're coming down with their flowing robes and all that, and, you know, they're supposed to be brothers, but there's a certain, I don't want to say homoeroticism between the two, Bo and Blake. They're kind of given names that at the time may have evoked a certain whatever, but in any event, They walk past Neidhart, and they give a glance to each other, which is hilarious. And then they both remove their capes at the same time and turn around and just start beating on Jim Neidhart, which I don't know why that cracked me up so much, the way they put that all together. But they beat down the anvil in the aisle, and they work him over good for a little bit. And then what they do at the end is they do the Midnight Express hug that they would do at the beginning of their matches. We get a hug Jim Cornette, or like what the Fabulous Rougeos would do, where you see Jacques and Raymond kind of hug each other. And that's something that I humorously incorporated into my life to work old wrestling into my everyday life, or at least a small part of it. Of course, I've mentioned on this podcast several times that I am a season ticket holder for the Boston Bruins, and my friend Merrill and I, we sit next to each other at these games, and after Bruins home game losses, of which there were many this past season, I think 21 or 22 by my count, we would reenact the Rougeau brother hug, and I'm pretty sure that Merrill had no idea what it was. I think I may have tried to explain it once, but it was done for my own real edification, and that's pretty much that. So Jack Tunney has another decision to make. There was a lot on Tunney's desk in late 91. He was a very, very busy man. And then we get a Beverly Brothers promo, which, I gotta tell you, the capes really don't do much for them when they're talking, but I'll play what they had to say.
Neidhart, next time you see us coming, step aside. That's not an example, Neidhart. That was a lesson. Don't you ever get in our way again.
I did cut out the part where the genius talked for them briefly at the beginning, but it's really just to kind of give the impression that they were not good talkers, either one of them. But in fairness to those two guys, I should mention that Mike Enos is a very good worker, and that is the reason why he stayed around for such a long time to come.
You see, what's mine is mine. And what's yours is mine too.
And that is one of the vignettes that led to the debut of Repo Man, debuting here against Reno Riggins. And the Repo Man, of course, is Barry Darsow, a.k.a. Hole-in-One Darsow, a.k.a. Demolition Smash, a.k.a. Crusher Khrushchev. And what I'm kind of curious about is when the audience at that time in 91 figured out, or more accurately, how they figured out that Demolition Smash was now Repo Man, that it was actually him. For me, it was I guess he did a poor job of covering up that arm tattoo that I recognized as being the same as Smash, and that was how I figured it out. Right, a lot of people figured it out based on the voice or whatever, but it's kind of funny, that exercise, because the only reason why he ever got to be Demolition Smash was because they tried to repurpose one of the Moondogs, Spot, into the Demolition Smash role, and it failed because too many people recognized him, and Darsow was put into the spot shortly thereafter. Not that that was going to be a real issue with Repo Man. This was not going to be a big drawing heel or anything like that. And in that vignette that just aired, he mentions that the guy was late by a day on his car payment. Which is very interesting, because to say that he was late by a day would indicate that did he pay it a day late, or was the due date yesterday and he's there to repossess the car? So he's there in the middle of the night, presumably after midnight. So you're thinking, okay, did he let the entire business day go by and now he is there to repossess the car? Now, this is a real heel move by him, because he kicks in the window and takes the car, and you hear the dog barking at the end. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how Repo Men are supposed to work, and I guess this is what makes him a heel, because he's breaking all the rules that were established for Repo Men. The repossessor cannot breach the peace in repossessing the car. But before that, I should mention that if you default on your car payment, they're more likely to repossess if it is a much newer car. They must first send you a notice of the default and give you the right to make up the payments, called a right to cure, before repossessing your car. This is all from NOLO.com, which is a legal site. As for the cannot breach the peace, a repossession company generally can't use force to get to your vehicle. Repossessions must occur without any breach of the peace. Unfortunately, breach of the peace is defined very broadly. It is usually legal for a repossessor to hotwire a car. It's unclear what Repo Man did in this case, because it's very dark. You can't exactly see, but it looks like he may have hotwired it. It is legal to use a duplicate key and take a car. Most courts have said it's legal to remove a car from a carport or an open garage, meaning the door is up. In most states, it's legal to take a car from a garage if the door is closed but unlocked. This is all kind of irrelevant, because the car in this case, in the vignette, is in the driveway. The repossession company does not have unlimited power to take your car. If you or someone else, like a relative, objects at the time that the repossessor tries to take your car so that taking the car would breach the peace, he or she must stop. However, this doesn't mean you get to keep your car. The repossessor can try again another day or get a court order to take the car. A word of warning, over the past several years, some consumers and agents attempting to repossess cars have reportedly been injured or killed, and children have been hauled away when the car was repossessed. Don't put yourself or others in danger just to keep your car. No car is worth an altercation that could escalate to physical harm. So yes, don't mess with the Repo Man, because he has a very solid move set and can cut the same promo over and over and over again. And that's just kind of a brief history of Repo. And I don't know where the idea would have come from this. I know there's been a lot of Barry Darso shoot interviews, and I've listened to some of them. He claims that this character was eventually going to get turned babyface, which I don't quite get how that would have worked. Would he have become a repo man who was abiding by the laws and wasn't breaching the peace? Because the whole idea is, oh, he's only late on his car payment by one day. Of course, the other thing to consider is the United States was in something of a recession, really more of an economic slowdown in late 1991. And I don't think it fed into that. I don't think WWF was creating characters based on the current climate. As I've said many times, a lot of the characters are based on lagging indicators. I know with Outback Jack that I covered in episode 4, that was pretty close to when Doc Crocodile Dundee came out. So, in any event, we got Repo Man debuting here against Reno Riggins. And Reno Riggins is a longtime enhancement guy on TV, but he is not just an enhancement guy. He's going to need to get the full bio treatment like used to get from Kelly on the Titans of Wrestling. So here we go. Riggins was born Neil Hargrove in 1967 in Nashville, Tennessee, and was a childhood friend of one Jeff Jarrett. He played football in high school, was All-State as kind of a undersized, plucky linebacker type. Because Riggins never really the biggest guy. He was very short of stature. But despite that, after getting refused for training by Jerry Jarrett, he trained with Tojo Yamamoto and was in the same training group as one Sid Udy, Sid Vicious. And after training for 2 years, he eventually worked TV for an indie in Pensacola, Florida, something called World Organizational Wrestling that apparently had a very young Bob Holly, a young Yokozuna, and other guys like Don Fargo and Burt Prentice. And it's kind of an interesting story how Riggins ended up in the WWF. He worked all sorts of different promotions. WCW, he was in for a few shots as well around 1990. He even worked global tapings in 91. Ended up in Smoky Mountain Wrestling later when that got going, and probably had his most success, in fact, not probably, certainly had his most success in the USWA, where he had a brief reign as the Southern Heavyweight Champion after defeating Brian Christopher and defending it against the likes of Brickhouse Brown, and there was a double DQ against Brian Christopher as well, and he eventually lost the title back to Christopher. But it's an interesting story how he got started in the WWF. It was one of those deals where he just wanted to get in the door and was hanging around. So WWF was doing a taping in Nashville in 1988, so he crashed the show, and he fooled the security into believing that he was the delivery man, and he ran into the somewhat notorious Terry Garvin, who was effectively the number three guy or number four guy in the WWF hierarchy. And according to an article on Riggins that was actually published by Serendipity 10 years ago today, as this show is being released, June 21st, 2007, he had a conversation and it was recounted with Terry Garvin. Now, this is a little bit difficult on a one-man podcast to try and do, and I don't know what Terry Garvin sounds like. And in fact, I don't even know what Reno Riggins sounds like. So I'm just going to kind of pretend like it's a play here. Hey, kid, is there something I can help you with? Yeah, these eight jabronis over here can't seem to tell me who I need to see to get a job. You wrestle? Yes, sir, I wrestle. How long you been wrestling? I've been wrestling a couple of years. You have? Well, who trained you? Tojo Yamamoto trained me. Tojo Yamamoto? Yes, sir. Well, Tojo used to be my roommate back in Canada a few weeks back. Really? So who do I see about getting a job? I'm the guy who hires and fires. Since you trained with Tojo, as a favor to him, I will let you try out. We could possibly use you on our next two dates, as our show is in Bristol, and the night after that we're in Winston-Salem, if you survive Bristol. Yeah, I don't know why I was giving a southern accent there to Terry Garvin, who is actually from the Montreal area. I would have just probably given him the Pat Patterson voice if I had decided to go that way. So, it's a very interesting article on Reno Riggins and kind of his whole history. And there's one anecdote that I was particularly taken with that kind of relates to a story that happened, or that came out at least recently, in the wrestling world. Riggins was good friends with the late Owen Hart and was a victim of several of Owen's legendary practical jokes. One time, Hart had Riggins paranoid about losing his passport as they were minutes from clearing customs in Singapore. Of course, Owen helped him, quote, find it. Now, the more recent story for somebody stealing a passport is the infamous JBL stealing Justin Roberts' passport on an overseas tour. So you're probably wondering, you know, why would JBL get all sorts of crap for that, and why would you never hear anything about the Owen Hart deal? Well, I think it's pretty obvious, and it's that people loved Owen Hart and wouldn't say a bad thing about him, whereas JBL is a complete dink. Now, we do actually have a match here. I shouldn't forget about that. And Piper just promptly buries the Repo Man immediately by pointing out his attire. So, oh, what do we got? The Lone Ranger here?
What do we got? The Lone Ranger here? What's this?
No, I understand.
A Tonto.
This is another one of those matches where there seems to be a little bit more going on in commentary, including some stuff I certainly missed back in 1991, because I would have had no idea what they were talking about. Macho Man wants to go check his car, and then they suggest that Vince go check his car. Piper makes reference to something that I listened to like six times. And if you go through my Twitter feed where I say that I'm exhausted from trying to figure out all of Piper's non sequitur references on commentary, this is the point where I became exhausted, and we're only about 11 minutes into the episode of Superstars. I mean, Piper is, oh my God, he just wears me out with like just the constant, it's like he's Mork or something. It's like if Robin Williams had become a wrestling announcer. But they make a reference to how Repo Man is wearing a mask, and how there is another masked man called Mr. Madness. And this was Macho Man's alter ego that was subbing in on some of the shows in place of Sid. And he would appear under a mask as Mr. Madness. And I had no idea. I'd never seen any of these because they were all house shows. But sure enough, the WWF last week announced the release coming up this September of an Unseen Matches DVD from the mid-80s through the mid-90s. They'll be releasing a lot of stuff that people haven't seen before. And one of the things on that DVD will be a Mr. Madness match, which is Macho Man Randy Savage under a mask. So they're going to get my money for that, both for that match and that weird Powers of Pain versus Demolition match from a TV taping in 88 that was to introduce the Powers of Pain as baby faces, and they were accompanied by Tito Santana. It was one of those deals where they were listed as having Tito Santana as a manager on some database, and I was like, when the hell did that happen? And it was a dark part of a TV taping to establish them as baby faces for when they would do their for real squash match later on. There actually is a match here. I do remember that there is a match, and the Repo Man gets to win with a leg lock, which is called a crowbar, I guess, where he just kind of ties up the guy's leg. It's kind of just really a basic leg lock. Vince McMahon, he calls it as, quote, most interesting submission maneuver. So Vince, not entirely sure what they should have called the move. I think a good move for the Repo Man's finisher would have been the Denver boot, since he was kind of locking the leg down in the same way that you would apply a Denver boot to an automobile. Now, granted, I know that when he's repossessing the car, he's bringing it away, but a Denver boot would accomplish the same thing in terms of a person would not be able to move their car out. And whenever I hear Denver boot, I always think of one of the great, kind of a great joke by one Adam Carolla. Of course, I've listened to his podcast for many years, not quite listening as often lately, but he had a good bit about the Denver boot. Said, there's nothing that'll brighten your day quite so much as a Denver omelet, and nothing that'll darken your day quite so much as the Denver boot. So Repo Man here picks up a win. They're not exactly putting him over on commentary. They're much more concerned about other things.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Sean Mooney is in the event center, and of course, we are plugging that Survivor Series is coming up before you know it. And we get some promos. Well, we get one promo right now. We're going to get promos from other teams later in the show. But this is a rather interesting group of four we have, which is the Jake the Snake Roberts team. His teammates are IRS and the Natural Disasters. And when I look at it, I'm immediately struck by the fact Earthquake is standing right behind Jake. The bag with the snake, or the snake handling bag, it obviously doesn't have the snake in it. Earthquake is right, it's right between Jake and Earthquake, the guy who killed his pet snake on television back in May. And now they're all just cool? I know that there's been a lot of weird Survivor Series teams over the years, particularly in 1987 when you had Paul Orndorff and Hulk Hogan on the same team less than a year after their huge feud that lasted for many, many months and culminated in the steel cage match at Saturday Night's Main Event. On that same show, you had Macho Man Randy Savage and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat on the same team after their feud that spilled even all the way past WrestleMania 3. Those I could forgive in retrospect, based on the, well, these guys had some wars with each other and they've developed a mutual respect. Kind of like the Sheamus and Cesaro thing that you see now, where they're now a cohesive tag team because they developed respect for one another. But Earthquake, he straight up killed Jake's pet, tied him in the ropes, and killed him right in front of him. That is some straight up evil stuff there. And Jake apparently is just fine with it. And I suppose it makes sense because Jake is completely psychotic and evil, the most evil heel that the WWF had come up with during that time. So maybe my time here trying to provide logic to something that late 91 Jake Roberts was doing is just a fool's errand.
See the Survivor Series Wednesday night, November 27th, available on a pay-per-view basis. Call your local cable company for availability.
I love that Howard Finkel voice that's slightly different from his normal ring announcer voice and from his regular voice, and also different from the one that they would play over matches and say that the Big Boss Man is coming to the Cumberland County Civic Center in Portland, Maine. It's there's something a little bit different, and I would love to use that for everyday things. Like, honey, I have to go drop off the yard waste because they're closing it at noon. I have to go clean my grill now if I want to make 20 chicken wings later with Old Bay seasoning. Now we have IRS taking on Greg the Hammer Valentine, as I had mentioned, in a rematch from SummerSlam 1991 that I'm not sure anybody really needed to see, since IRS won fairly cleanly at the event. He may have pulled the tights or whatever. I meant to go back and watch that match, but I don't really see the need to. I mean, it was just a kind of a throwaway thing in the middle of that card. Of course, it was billed, and as it should be here, as the Battle of the W4 versus the Figure 4. And for those of you outside of the United States who may not know what the W4 is, it is a tax form in the U.S. to kind of decide withholdings for your taxes, so you can withhold extra money from your taxes so that you don't owe at the end of the year. Form W-4, otherwise known as the Employees Withholding Allowance Certificate, is an Internal Revenue Service, IRS, tax form completed by an employee to indicate his or her tax situation to the employer. The W-4 form tells the employer the correct amount of tax to withhold from an employee's paycheck. And I have to screw around with those myself, because I ended up owing a lot last year when I filed, and that's never particularly pleasant. I always like to get it, and this is my tax advice to you, since we're on an IRS match who seems to turn up on this show time and time again. My advice is try and get it as close to zero as possible. Yes, it's nice to have a big refund at the end of the year, but what you're doing then is you're allowing a government to hold your money in effectively an escrow for no interest whatsoever. You're better off having that money and having it in an interest-bearing account. I work in finance, but really not that kind of finance. IRS cuts his usual highly original promo before the match can begin.
You can read about the layoffs and the cutbacks in the newspaper every day, but make no mistake, that's no excuse for you people not to pay your taxes.
Thanks, Irwin, for your contributions. As I said, very highly original. Now, Greg the Hammer Valentine is a babyface here, and he always seemed like something of an ill fit as a babyface because he was a heel for so long, and he just comes off as kind of a rough, tough heel. And it made me wonder, why would you make Greg the Hammer Valentine a babyface other than the fact that you were really just kind of phasing him out? And my mind kind of went to a different place, and thinking of the year 1991 and where society was at that time, did they make him a babyface because MC Hammer was such a big deal at the time, and now the term Hammer would be associated with good guys? Goddamn, we got, do you see this guy, MC Hammer? He's too legit to quit. Now, of course, that album had actually just been released before this aired on October 29th, 1991, the album Too Legit to Quit, which was the follow-up to the earlier album, Please Hammer, Don't Hurt 'Em, which came out very early in 1990, that had You Can't Touch This. Now, whereas Greg Valentine got the name The Hammer because of his deadly elbow drop in the 1970s, including one that, I guess, put Johnny Weaver out for a lengthy period of time, MC Hammer got his name for his run with the Oakland Athletics in the mid-1970s as the bat boy and somehow the executive vice president. For those of you who don't follow baseball, the A's of the 1970s had a very eccentric owner by the name of Charlie Finley, who took a liking to this young lad who would breakdance in the parking lot and used him not only as the bat boy and executive vice president, I don't think he did anything other than be a stooge for Finley, and the players nicknamed him Pipeline. However, another nickname for young Stanley Burrell was Hammer, and that was due to his resemblance to home run king Hank Aaron, a.k.a. Hammer and Hank. So, you can close the book on both Hammers there. It is kind of fun to hear Roddy Piper on commentary putting over Greg Valentine with Valentine as a babyface because of their obvious history together dating to Starrcade 1983, and they remained good pals all the way up to Roddy Piper's death, and I believe it should still be on iTunes. I don't think anything ever gets dropped from there, iTunes or Apple Music, whatever you want to call it. The Rowdy Roddy Piper podcast that had so much controversy with the Steve Austin thing, well, kind of lost in some of that was one of his last podcasts. And in fact, may have been the last podcast that he did was with Greg the Hammer Valentine. And that was a fairly fun listen. I believe it was released in July of 2015, which was the month that Piper died. So that might be something that you could go give a listen to. We start out here. We get the ref intervention there with both guys in the corner where Valentine is pushed back and the referee kind of gets in the middle of everything, and IRS takes advantage to gain control, but the Hammer fights back with some of those elbows. Piper in cheering off Valentine, this is another one of those things that really strikes the ear where he yells, "Come on, Gregory!" I have never once thought of Greg Valentine in my life as being Gregory Valentine, so it's just really strange. It's also, Greg is one of those names that has to be shortened to Greg from Gregory, because Gregory just sounds, that doesn't sound right. They reference how Valentine, of course, a master of the figure four leg lock, and mention that Ric Flair, of course, using the figure four leg lock in injuring Jim the Anvil Neidhart the week before. And it just makes me wonder, you really couldn't have given us, say, a 10-minute TV match between Ric Flair and Greg the Hammer Valentine, because that would have been a hell of a lot of fun, and I think it would have been more of a bone to Greg Valentine. I think there's a little bit more, it would have made him feel a little bit better to be used to put Ric Flair over rather than to put IRS over a second time. So I don't know. What, like, in this Flair run, you get some odd Flair TV matches, and it's fun that he got to face younger Shawn Michaels and some other guys, but it would have been good to see the old tag partners from the Crockett territory go at each other one last time. You get the Hammer firing up with some forearms and chops. The Hammer could always lay in those chops. And then a Beal out of the corner. And then we get a really strange ref bump. Yeah, we have a ref bump in a match that lasts less than 5 minutes, and it's one of those ref bumps where he doesn't get knocked too hard, but he just kind of gets knocked down for a brief second. And in that time frame, IRS grabs the briefcase and hits Valentine from behind in the back of the head, and then goes for the pin. But here comes the big boss man to break up the pin. And you could see that IRS wanted to position himself in such a way that he could have his legs pulled by the boss man who was running in, because they were a little bit too far from the ropes there. And boss man breaks up the pin, and that's the DQ. So IRS will pick up the victory. And boss man, I had forgotten about this era of the big boss man, where he's wearing a pretty cool leather jacket, and it's I think it might have the Confederate flag on there, and I can't necessarily endorse that, but it's kind of evoking the Finn Balor jacket game some quarter of a century before that ever was a thing. And it made me wonder why boss man went downhill so fast after, you know, appearing in a jacket that was so nice looking. And then I remembered, oh yeah, that's right, he was feuding with IRS, and that has never really done much for anybody's career. Just ask Tatanka in 1994 how that went for him.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Big Boss Man turns out to be Greg the Hammer Valentine's guardian angel, but no doubt the former prison guard is not planning to be an angel 1 week from this Wednesday night, November 27th, at the Survivor Series, Thanksgiving Eve.
And that is why I love doing this show, for stuff like Sean Mooney seeing into the future and knowing that the Big Boss Man was going to be given a guardian angel gimmick a couple of years later. It's friggin' unbelievable that Sean Mooney is just so wise and underrated, and I had an appreciation for him anyway, but it's only been enhanced by just the little stuff like that it's amazing. But we got a Survivor Series update, and it kind of comes in two parts here, as we get the Mooney part, and we get a promo from the, I don't know if they had, they didn't really have a, I guess Piper would have been the captain of this team. And this crew is made up of Virgil, the British Bulldog, Roddy Piper, and Bret the Hitman Hart, who somehow is not the captain, even though he's the Intercontinental Champion. And they do a thing where they appear on screen one by one to say their piece, and they all, you know, join together at the end. Virgil still has the $1 million belt, so he's very, very happy because it makes those 8x10s fly off the shelf. Then we get the British Bulldog, and he talks about his never-ending issues with the Warlord, which had escalated around this time period when he body-slammed or power-slammed the Doctor of Style, Slick, and that was how Slick was written off as a manager to be replaced by Harvey Whippleman. Piper then comes in with his kooky little I scare flare business, and then Bret comes in last and refers to his electrocution by the Mountie, which was an angle that they did where they threw water on Bret and then got him with the shock stick, complete with the sound effects and all that business. And that was how the Brett Mountie thing got started in earnest, which of course would culminate just before the Royal Rumble, when the Mountie would capture the title and would go on to become the greatest 48-hour Intercontinental Champion of all time. The thing that struck me the most, and I'm going to have to post the screen cap of this either on Twitter or on Facebook, why is the Bulldog holding Brett like a prom date photo? He kind of has his hands like around Brett's waist, like they're posing for the prom photo, you know, outside the limo or town car with the parents are outside to take the picture before they go, or in like the formal setting with the background at the prom or the semi-formal. Like, what is going on there? I know that they're family, but it just looked really, really weird. Then we go to Okerlund. He has his own Survivor Series report. Sid is out, as Okerlund tells us. Sid has been placed on the 60-day disabled list, which will open up room on the 40-man roster. And, of course, everybody hopes that the Macho Man will fill that role. That's a nice little baseball reference for all of you out there. Although Sid, you know, obviously more of a softball guy.
Legion of Doom and the Big Boss Man certainly would welcome the Macho Man Randy Savage in time for the Survivor Series to pinch hit for Sid Justice.
Given Savage's earlier career in minor league baseball, I guess it would make sense to have him pinch hit for Sid Justice. And we get a promo from the Legion of Doom and the Big Boss Man, and they need to know if the Macho Man is in, and they're playing that up to see, you know, we don't know what's going to happen there. And of course, what would happen is they would make that match 3-on-3, where Jake would be, I guess, de facto suspended to bring it to a 3-on-3 rather than reinstating the Macho Man at the point, because they were saving Jake versus Macho for the Tuesday in Texas, so they just made it a 3-on-3. And that was a really bizarre match where you had a couple of briefcase spots by IRS. Yeah, I know. They IRS overusing a trope. I can't believe it. And then the natural disaster is walking out on him. Next, we have promos from Ric Flair's team. And what a crew this is. Ric Flair, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, the Mountie, and the Warlord. What a mix of characters. Of course, having Rick and Ted together, something about that just feels right. And the Mountie there, all right, he is what he is. But the Warlord, that's really weird. And then we get to the promo, and everybody gets to say their piece. And I love when the Warlord starts talking, Flair kind of looks over his left shoulder like, oh yeah, that guy's here too. I would be remiss if I did not mention the Undertaker and Paul Bearer promo that was right before the Flair promo. Although that just kind of annoyed me because Gene screwed up the pronunciation of confidant. He said confident, said the Undertaker's confident, Paul Bearer. And it just really bugged me the way he said that. And now Okerlund addresses the Jim the Anvil Neidhart who is now out of the Survivor Series. He would eventually be replaced by Sergeant Slaughter. And at this time of 1991, they were running the I Want My Country Back vignettes, which culminated in him doing the Pledge of Allegiance in a classroom full of children. And where he basically said, all right, that's it. Got my country back now. And then he saved Duggan from an attack by the Nasty Boys on the November 24th episode of Wrestling Challenge. So that was how he, and then he kissed the flag and saluted it and this and that kind of stuff. So that was how they emergency turned Sergeant Slaughter back face, because the Iraq thing was not going to work much longer. And their opponents, actually, Slaughter's team, full team, is Slaughter, Duggan, Tito Santana, and the Texas Tornado. And their opponents, this is one of the weirdest and worst Survivor Series teams of all time. And this is the original team, as one of the guys would leave beforehand. We have Colonel Mustafa, the Berserker, Big Bully Busick, and Skinner. So I don't know who the captain out of that crew is. I guess it would be Mustafa. But Big Bully Busick, he would wrestle his last match a week from now against Bret Hart. And he would be replaced by Hercules, thereby keeping Herc's pay-per-view streak alive. And then finally, the last match, the Rockers and the Bushwhackers join forces to face the Nasty Boys and the Beverly Brothers, a match that has more than just a slight whiff of the AWA on it. And they go back to the arena to those piped-in reinstate chants, and they're talking about how Jack Tunney has a decision to make. So once again, we get another Jack Tunney promo on television, and here's what he has to say.
As president of the World Wrestling Federation, I am well aware of the recent and overwhelming show of public support for the reinstatement of the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Let it be known that this office does not take this issue lightly and has once again taken the matter under advisement.
Saying you've taken something under advisement is a fantastic way of just blowing off a problem and, you know, forgetting that it ever happened. It would take the man literally getting bit by a cobra in order for him to get reinstated. I'm just saying, from a kayfabe perspective, Tunney let the whole thing get out of hand. Not to make another baseball reference, but it's kind of like letting a beanball war, like having three hit by pitches. Tunney, this is all Tunney's fault, and it was all on him. And really, what I'm saying is that Jake the Snake Roberts was right. This was all Jack Tunney's fault. Anyway, right now we have the Natural Disasters, and they are taking on the team of Burt Styles and Tom Stone. Styles, not to be confused with the Burt Styles, who was a short story author during World War II who actually died in the war. There are some issues that I have with the Natural Disasters as a team. They were perfectly fine big men, you know, as a unit, as kind of a monster heel team. And I do think it was a good idea to put them against the LOD and make the LOD somewhat of an underdog from a size perspective. But the number one problem with that team is I'm not buying Typhoon as a monster heel. He's got some weird charm or goofiness or something to him, which of course would become apparent when you trip over a piece of wood as the Shockmaster 2 years later. But I'm just not buying him as a monster heel. And I don't think they were either, because 4 months from now, the Natural Disasters are going to be turned babyface in kind of a rush job where they put the titles on IRS and Ted DiBiase off the Legion of Doom. And instead of just giving the titles to the Natural Disasters. And I think part of it was the problem of Typhoon not quite being at that same level as Earthquake. Another issue with the Natural Disasters is it took Earthquake out of singles competition. Now, I don't know if he had a health issue or something where he had to go to tags. He looked perfectly fine and spry in the ring here, Earthquake. Way more spry than the way he looked. This is a guy who was throwing drop kicks in WCW some 5 years after this point. My only problem with John Tenta is his legs could have definitely used a tan. It's very, very white and very, very pasty. I don't know what about it that bothers me versus other guys, but Hercules, I guess, was the same way. So maybe I'm just being a little hard on him. We get the WWF magazine. They're promoting that, and on the cover is Sid Justice. Oops. Yeah, that was a mistake. Of course, they didn't know that he was going to, you know, tear his bicep or anything like that. There's a lot of double-teaming in this match, and I was starting to turn into Jesse Ventura, saying that the referee lost control of this and was not even willing to make an effort to move one of Typhoon or Earthquake out of the ring. We get Typhoon, he's whipped by Earthquake into the corner for a big avalanche, and then Earthquake follows. So Typhoon actually ends up between the guy and Earthquake, which always makes me wonder, why doesn't that also hurt Typhoon? But he's actually protected by the power of being fat, or at least that's the way I'm explaining it to myself. As I said, referee just loses control of this, like, crazy. Styles gets sent to the outside, and then we get the double splash finish, which is the Typhoon big splash finish, which I'll hand it to old Uncle Fred Ottman. He did a pretty good big splash, much the same way that Big E does these days in WWE. And then the Earthquake sit-down, senton, whatever you want to call it, splash to finish it off. Then they're talking about kind of the Survivor Series, and they're showing a replay of, I think it was the Avalanche part of it. Oh, there's a future gimmick for John Tenta. And Vince has something to say.
We're talking about a squash.
Yeah, I know, Vince. Other podcasts may talk about pay-per-views or the Clash of the Champions or other super shows or the news from a certain time period. On this show, I'm one man who just talks about squash matches. In keeping with all of the baseball references I've been making on this show, in episode 12, I had referred to the Funeral Parlor as a talk show that had a pretty high batting average. You could say it had a very high OPS plus. But an advanced stat I'm adding for wrestling, angle quality added. And that would be the number of points of quality that it added to a particular angle. And this would be the highest rated one of them all, at least in my opinion, for the sheer star power, for what it accomplished, for the memory that it left me with, and goddamn, for the Ric Flair promo that we're going to get when he confronts Hulk Hogan. And Hulk Hogan comes out, and Paul Bearer is doing his thing there. Oh, yes! Now, the Hogan pop here is good, but you can notice it's not 1989 good. So 2 years after, it's not quite the same. That something is off the rose. It's perhaps imperceptible. Maybe I didn't notice it at the time. Although at this point in 91, I was starting to tire of Hogan a bit. It was little stuff like Hogan, if you notice, his eyebrows there are much darker shade. Kind of like what you would see in WCW in the mid-90s. So I kind of treat the Hogan eyebrows kind of like a mood ring. When they're lighter, you get a better Hogan. But when they turn darker, you get kind of the, all right, we're really sick of you, Hogan. If you can't even be bothered to color your eyebrows, I don't know what to do with you anymore. And Paul Bearer is just kind of taunting Hogan, who is very wary here. And kind of gives off the sense that he's a little bit scared here, or a little bit frightened. That is what is he, at least he's conveying that to me. And Paul Bearer, isn't this casket nice? And much like what you had with the Ultimate Warrior back in the April episode of Superstars, you have a casket that has all sorts of Hulkamania stickers and Hulkster stickers. And he invites Hogan to take a look at what will be his final resting place. And Hogan kind of leans in and is going to open it to make sure that the Undertaker isn't in there or whatever. And he opens it very carefully, very slowly, and sees that it's empty. And at this point now, we get Ric Flair emerging from the back wearing the green Nature Boy robe. So that they were not billing him as the Nature Boy in WWF, but I think they just let him keep the Nature Boy robes because to ask him to get all new robes would have been too much, although he did wear a robe that said Ric Flair on it at one point, which I always found kind of funny that he put his entire name on there. And the belt, as I said, is not pixelated, but Flair, what he does is he's got his green robe, like I said, and he kind of unties it. And if you know anything about Ric Flair, when he unties his robe, perhaps you should be a little concerned about what might be coming.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
No, for once, Flair is not showing off his junk to people in the Marriott Hotel bar. Instead, he's showing off the real world championship belt, which, as I said, not pixelated here. And it's always kind of a disappointment the way they would trash the belt on television. You had Piper spitting on it at one point. Monsoon would do everything he could to run down that belt. And, of course, as the story goes, Flair mailed the belt to Vince McMahon to kind of let him know that, hey, I'm in play here. So Flair is out to confront Hogan, and this is so amazing, this promo. And it's something straight out of Techwood Studios, in my opinion. It's like Flair ranting against Jimmy Garvin back in 87 or something along those lines. It's almost as if Ric Flair is a proxy for the Southern wrestling or NWA fan for all those years in the 80s who had to put up with Hulk Hogan being this national guy where Ric Flair was their champion and the superior wrestler slash worker, as it were. And the promo that Flair cuts in Hogan's face is amazing because he's basically a proxy for every fan of the NWA.
Come on over here. You know how long I've been waiting for this very moment, big man, huh?
Hey,
you know
how
long the real world champion has heard the name Hulk Hogan? You know how long I've had to listen to you talk about the 24-inch pythons, big man? Don't be ashamed of those butterflies you got rumbling in that stomach right now. Because, big man, I just burst that bubble you've been living in, and I'm here on your doorstep with the real world championship belt. Compare the two. In closing, what are you gonna do, Hulk Hogan, when Ric Flair runs wild on you?
Now that promo is so great for so many reasons, and it's Flair conveying the magnitude of the moment, because this is the first time Hogan and Flair have faced off on television. And it was something that had been kind of dreamed about, really, all the way back to 1984, when Hogan won the WWF title from the Iron Sheik. And at that time, Flair was the NWA champion. And so it would be for much of the rest of the 1980s, you had these two worlds, these two kingpins, and never would they ever meet. And this, it's finally happening right now. And Flair did a good job conveying how big of a deal it was. And I knew as a 12-year-old how big of a deal it was, because in reading the After magazines and all that, I know that they had had a cover about Hogan versus Flair, and it was like a who would win it, you know, in one of those deals. But Flair did a magnificent job there. He also did a great job putting over his own belt, and then also the mocking of Hulk Hogan at the end was not something that you would see very often. I don't recall too many instances of guys coming in to WWF and mocking the things that Hogan would do with the promos and, what are you gonna do, Hulk Hogan, when Ric Flair runs wild on you? Now, there are also a few other details that make this great. Hogan was going over to the standing coffin, and I've now kind of learned my lesson from episode 12. The casket is the thing lying horizontal there that Warrior got locked in. The coffin is the thing that is standing upright, that's made of wood and kind of has that weird pentagonal shape there. And Hogan is walking over to try and open that when Flair interrupts. And that's important because The Undertaker, as we would see, was actually in there. So Flair prevented Hogan from finding out that The Undertaker was just there laying in wait for him. And Hogan is running down Flair's belt and just kind of doing some usual jibber-jabber. And the way they shoot it is from behind the standing coffin, and you see the door open. I feel that was very well shot there. I don't want to give any credit to Kevin Dunn or anything if he had anything to do with that. But hey, you know, that it was a good job by them there. And Taker comes out, grabs an urn, and hits Hogan in the back of the head. Now all hell is broken loose here. And Flair, to his credit, he grabs Hogan's belt, and he lifts the big gold belt and the winged eagle belt. And I wish that he had faced the camera when he was doing that, because that would be the screen cap of this show, but there really wasn't a good shot of it. So Undertaker is working over Hogan, and I don't know if this was done with the memory of what happened to the Ultimate Warrior in April, being locked in the casket for 3 minutes and 46 seconds, but Piper and Savage leave the broadcast booth and go to join the fray to try and help out Hogan, even though they have both been sworn enemies of Hogan in the past. I also should mention how hilarious Paul Bearer is during this, because you have Flair getting in Hogan's face, and in the middle of it, you have Paul Bearer making those Paul Bearer faces where he's twisting and contorting his head. That was just wonderful. Savage and Piper come to the rescue with chairs. Piper gets in a rather weak shot on Flair to just kind of drive him away from the fray. And Savage, as the Undertaker is kind of standing over Hogan, hits him in the left arm with a chair, that, and Taker just kind of shrugs it off with his arm. And that was incredibly badass, because guys did not no-sell chair shots back then. And Taker just shrugs it off with his arm like he was a running back doing a stiff arm. And Undertaker goes to one knee, and Piper and Savage wind up with the chair because they're not sure what he's going to do. And he grabs the crucifix that Hogan is wearing and rips it right off and drops it on his chest. And of course, that's screaming a callback to the Piper's Pit segment from 1987, which I covered in episode 4, where Andre ripped the crucifix off Hulk Hogan. Of course, he cut him with the crucifix as he was doing it. But those two segments are forever linked because of that. And also, Piper is there in both of them. And in this case here, every single guy is a WWE Hall of Famer, except for The Undertaker, which will happen whenever he decides he wants it to happen. So you have 6 Hall of Famers in one segment. And it's just crazy the amount of star power you have here. And The Undertaker is just, like I said, he's just an incredible badass. Hogan, never mind my whole weird eyebrow thing that I was talking about earlier, he just looks incredibly weak, and WWF makes an uncharacteristic mistake with their production now. I had praised them earlier. Bruce Pritchard had talked about on one of, it had to have been one of the Hulk Hogan shows that he did on Something to Wrestle With, that they would go out of their way to not shoot the top of Hulk Hogan's head, because, of course, he was balding. And as he's being helped to his feet by Piper and Savage, the camera is right at the top of Hogan's head, and you can kind of see the see how the progress that's been made since the Hogan you remember from the mid-80s, where he's lost quite a bit more hair. By the way, top of Hogan's head, that would be a good name for a podcast if anybody wants to start one. But you know how long it took me to come up with Greetings from Allentown? Like an absurd amount of time. It took me like 6 weeks to actually come up with a name for this show. That was actually held me back. So back to this. Paul Bearer on the way out, like, kind of mugs for the camera. Ooh, it's just amazing. It's certainly the greatest funeral parlor that ever was. It might be the most star-studded segment in WWE history. I can't think of one that has more than 6 Hall of Famers. I'd save for maybe a point in a Royal Rumble or something like that. But holy crap. For the promo by Flair, the callback to an earlier great segment, and the star power. Oh, man. What what a segment this was. You got me feeling emotions. now we got, as the palate cleanser here, the poor British Bulldog has got to run out there to finish this up, and he is taking on Mike Samples, who is no relation to Junior Samples from the television show Hee Haw, nor is he the Mike Samples who played in the Canadian Football League for many years back in the day. This Mike Samples, at the exact same time as this aired, was appearing in the USWA under the Leatherface gimmick. And Mike is now retired. He was a wrestler for 15 years in both the United States and then later in Japan, and now operates a ring building business in Kentucky. And his website is monsterringsandcages.com if you're interested in any of the Mike Samples rings. Now, the British Bulldog, as I said during the promo that he had with the rest of his team, just spent 1991 in a constant feud with the Warlord in kind of a Power Man versus Power Man feud. In reality, those two guys were very close workout buddies in real life, so they had some chemistry together. I wouldn't call any of their matches particularly great, but they were certainly passable. He got more out of the Warlord than most people could. And on commentary here, because this is the palate cleanser, we're not going to really talk about the Bulldog on commentary. Instead, they're talking about what was going on back in the dressing room as Piper and Savage have rejoined the broadcast booth. And Savage didn't really say too much, but Piper says, "We'll let the guy be as a professional courtesy." And he kept using the term for professional courtesy, almost like it was the same thing as attorney-client privilege, which, as we all know, is something that Hogan has learned quite a lot about. The Bulldog, of course, was very built up at this point. He was quite jacked. I'm not going to say how he got to that point, but I have my suspicions. And there's really not too much going on in this match. One of the weird things about the Bulldog at this time period is he often would do his like old junior heavyweight style offense from the 80s, even as he's in this body that is now that of a big heavyweight guy. But here, literally, the whole match is three moves: a forearm, a clothesline, and the big British Bulldog running power slam to pick up the win, as Vince is looking for something from Roddy Piper about the condition of Hulk Hogan and professional courtesy and all that. But that, in reality, it's just tune in next week and we'll fill you in on what's happening with Hulk Hogan.
Right now it's 3-on-4. You guys better get some more people.
Survivor! Survivor! Survivor!
I hate to bring this up, but it's really weird and sad to see Kerry Von Erich there chanting Survivor! Survivor! Since we all know what happened to him less than a year and a half later. It's one of those topics that the whole Von Erich family thing. I talked about it in one of the earlier episodes. That might have also been episode 12. And I made fun of Kerry Von Erich's music, which is still horrible, but I really don't want to make too much light of the Von Erich family issues through the years. We don't have a YouTube comment theater because this is on, I don't know what the deal is with this particular user, where not enough people seem to be watching the videos from this user. As I'm looking at it right now, the Superstars from November 16th, 1991 has only 568 views, which is strange considering the fact that it was uploaded quite a while ago, at least 2 months ago, I think. You would think that this would be an episode that people would want to watch, but there's no description to it, so you would have to know that November 16th, 91 had the funeral parlor angle. In fact, this is another example where I am the only commenter in the YouTube comments, and all I wrote was, "Greatest funeral parlor of all time." And I've made that clear. So to kind of fill time before I say what's on next week's show, and I probably don't even need to do this, why don't I just do a little segment that I'll call questions. The first question is, Pete, why do you do this show by yourself? It seems a little strange that you would do a podcast solo when it's usually two or three people on other podcasts. Well, the answer to that is perhaps slightly embarrassing on my part. And no, it's not that I have no friends or anything like that. It's that simply, I have absolutely no idea how to record a podcast remotely with a person via Skype or whatever. I have no idea how to do that. And I almost felt like that was a barrier to entry, that just learning that was going to keep me from getting started. So I just started doing this to just get it off the ground. And, you know, if I needed to podcast with somebody later, I would do it then. I have been on other podcasts, which you may know, but I have not had anybody on this show, and you know, who knows what the future may bring. Second question, why do I not swear on the show? Do you have some sort of religious thing against swearing? Well, clearly not, because you heard me during the funeral parlor segment, although I bleeped it out. And the reason why I try not to swear, although I did use the S word in the episode 4 when talking about Outback Jack, so I think it was fully justified there. I kind of think of this show as a guy like me. I'm 38, who might be a dad. I have no children, but a guy who's driving his kid to baseball practice or soccer practice or whatever, and you have it on in the car, and you probably don't want me saying F this or F that or whatever. So that's really just kind of the idea. I reserve the right to change my mind on that as time goes along, but that was at least my operating theory on that. So that's our first edition, and maybe only edition, of questions. Now, for next Thursday's show, I want to take a trip back to 1993, and staying in the World Wrestling Federation. And we're approaching July 4th, which is Independence Day here in the United States. You have July 1st in Canada, which is Canada Day. And I figured I would take on something with a bit of a patriotic bent. And this would be the July 11th, 1993 episode of Wrestling Challenge. This will only be the second Wrestling Challenge episode, but no gorilla at this point. The hosts are Jim Ross and Bobby the Brain Heenan, as they were for much of 1993. And on this show, we have your usual WWF gimmicks there. You got Bastion Booger will be on the show. Atom Bomb, I'm looking forward to trying to figure out what I can say about Atom Bomb for his second appearance. Owen Hart is there, well in advance of his heel turn, about 6 months later. A main event, which is Bam Bam Bigelow and the Head Shrinkers taking on the Smoking Guns and Tatanka. And we'll find out who wins that match. Well, you know, maybe. It was kind of a weird deal there. And, oh yeah, the Body Slam Challenge on the USS Intrepid. A lot of people tried to slam Yokozuna, a lot of athletes of the day. No, none of the truly famous athletes, but I'm going to cover them one by one because Scotty Burrell and Peter Taglianetti, they deserve their moment in the sun for appearing on WWF television. Also, be on the lookout. I am planning a special. I alluded to it last week. It would be a special episode devoted to the anniversary of the creation of a specific character. I really don't want to give it away yet, but it would the anniversary of when this character debuted in, I'll say it's the WWF, is actually next Tuesday, June 27th. Be on the lookout for that. It should drop, hopefully, around that time. So do tune in to that and next Thursday's episode for another exciting edition of Greetings from Allentown.